This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a French family and some winemakers who took a risk and brought some grapes to the Central Coast.
They felt, based on the soils that they saw and the rainfall that they measured and the climate that they knew, that this was going to work.
And later, we'll talk to a local author about her new book and its theme of people looking to connect with others.
Quite often, these are broken people who have unmet needs, and they find them through this sense of belonging.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 20th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Today, we're going to kick off the show with KCBX's Director of Programming, Marisa Waddell. She recently sat down with two men quite familiar with Central Coast winemaking to talk about their journey of bringing Rhone grapes to the Central Coast and the big anniversary they're celebrating.
30 years ago, an American family and a French family formed a partnership around a desire to produce Rhone wines on the Central Coast. Robert Haas and brothers Jean-Pierre and François Perrin of Château de Pocastel in the Rhone Valley introduced Rhone wines locally at Tablas Creek Vineyard. And now the winery is one of the senior producers in the region. Robert's son, Jason, is now the general manager of Tablas Creek, and he's here with me, along with Jean-Pierre Perrin, to chat with us about the story behind the winery and Rhone wines on the Central Coast. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Marisa.
Jean-Pierre, I'd like to start with you. To get the story behind Tablas Creek, what was it about this region that attracted you to join Bob in bringing Rhone wines to California?
Yes. First of all, we decide to find the right region to grow Rhone varietals. Mm-hmm. We travel with Bob during 3 or 4 or 5 years to find the right climate, enough water, enough sun, not too warm, and calcare, which is in English...
Yeah. Calcareous soil.
Calcareous soil. Mm-hmm. You know, in U.S., it's very difficult to find calcareous soil. In Europe, yes. In the United States, it's very difficult. And we found calcare here, mm-hmm. in the mountains, there, between mm-hmm. the ocean and Paso. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason why we decide to start the project there.
And this is a kind of soil with high minerality and
right.
rocks mixed in. And tell me a little bit more about calcareous soil.
Yeah, it's old seabed, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's the dissolved and crushed up shells and bones of sea creatures that settle down to the bottom of the ocean over mm-hmm. time and gradually get compressed into something that's mostly rock. Mm-hmm. We'll still find, fish scale fossils inside it, find the occasional whale fossil inside. It's mm-hmm. It was stuff that 10 million years ago was underwater. Mm-hmm. And in the creation of the Santa Lucia Mountains over the last several million years, it's gotten pushed up. So in terms of what it does for wine grapes, it has this balance of good water retention. So it acts like a sponge and actually holds the moisture we get in the winter. But it'll allow extra water to drain. It is porous enough that you're not going to end up with standing water around the roots. And it's high pH, which helps balance topsoil, which tends to be acidic. So this soil is basic. It ends up allowing your vines to maintain their freshness over the course of the year and produces grapes that have great balance.
And it took you 5 years of searching, and you settled on this area in the western part of Paso Robles region.
Yes, because we were in Sierra Nevada, we were in Texas, we were in Oregon, we were everywhere in the United States.
And I'm assuming that the climate has something to do with it as well, with the fog in the morning and the sun in the afternoon.
Yeah, you know, we are in France. I was the fourth generation in the wine business in France. Of course, we have the knowledge of many hours of sun we need, how many inches of rain we need. And we tried during 4 or 5 years to find the same, in English, items, the same numbers.
Yeah, same.
The same numbers, like in France. And it appears that here, west of 101, Paso Robles in the mountains, 12 kilometers from the ocean, mm-hmm. we have such, what, such
similarity.
Numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, you had to import these Rhone plants from France. That must have been a really...
From my vineyard, yeah. We import small pieces of vines, of wood, to plant here. But mm-hmm. before to plant, it was necessary to index the free virus program before planting in the United States because the regulation of the government, you know, and...
There was a quarantine, a three-year quarantine.
3 years quarantine.
3 years.
Yeah. Oh, it was a long story.
Long time
Tablas
to
Creek
wait.
It was a long story. It's a very long story, Tablas Creek.
It is. And here we are 30 years later. So you imported these pieces of grapevine.
Yeah.
And you had to establish a nursery as well after waiting 3 years in quarantine.
Yeah, you're only allowed to bring in 6 cuttings of each type. So after you wait 3 years for these 6 vines to be declared free of virus and released to you, you've then got to reproduce them into enough to start planting your vineyard. So that took us another 2 years. So we bought the property in 89. We didn't have vines out of quarantine until 92. We didn't have enough to start planting until 94. And then it takes 3 more years to get your first crop. So that was 97.
So it takes patience to...
And money.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Luckily, the parents had a business in France that was able to keep them going. And my dad had an importing business, mm-hmm. which is, of course, how the two families got together. Mm-hmm. So they were able to develop Tablas Creek with an eye towards the long term, not have to worry about, can we get this to turn a profit in the short term? We're able to go at it saying, okay, if we look back with a generation's perspective, what choices would we make, and then mm-hmm. make those choices at the beginning. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests today are Jason Haas, who's the general manager of Tablas Creek Vineyard, and Jean-Pierre Perrin, who is one of the founders, along with his brother Francois and Jason's dad, Bob Haas. They're celebrating the 30th anniversary of Tablas Creek. Something that you did, which is significant, is you introduced Rhone wines to the Central Coast.
I mean, there were certainly a few producers who were focusing on Rhone varieties before us. I mean, you think of like Bob Lindquist at Cupé or Randall Graham at Bonnie Doon. But it was pretty scattered, and there were a lot of varieties that didn't exist, and there wasn't really a community of Rhone producers. And so one of the things that we've tried to do from the beginning is figure out ways to get the people who are working on the same challenges that we're working on together as part of a community. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, for me, been one of the most exciting things about the last 30 years is to see the extent to which there has grown up a Rhone community and the extent to which it's really centered in Paso Robles.
It wasn't that long ago when Californians had really only heard of Syrah as one of the Rhone grapes.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, you're talking like a decade.
Yeah.
Not even,
yeah.
Less,
not long. And now so many folks know about Grenache and Cunoise and Viognier and others. Was it difficult introducing these unfamiliar wines to the Californians and Americans' palates?
It was difficult, yeah, because American palate, they want from Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay or Pinot. And it was difficult to, on the list of the restaurants, help me, Jason.
On the wine lists and the shelves of retail shops.
The categories
didn't exist.
And there was no categories on the list of the restaurant for Rhone wines. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult to explain to the journalist, to the sommeliers that it was necessary to understand the Rhone grapes, the Rhone Valley.
I have a little bit of a different take. I would say that it was not difficult to introduce it to Americans' palates because these grapes are delicious.
They are
that
delicious.
That wasn't hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got fruit, they've got freshness, they've got richness, they've got tannin. They have all of the elements. So once you got people to taste them, that was pretty easy. The hard part was kind of figuring out where in the market there was space for them. Because as Jean-Pierre said, the lists had a section for Cabernet and a section for Merlot and maybe a section for Pinot Noir. And if you weren't one of those, you were in other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, one of the really, really wonderful developments in American wine over the last 10, 15, 20 years is that there's so much more familiarity with not just Rhones, but things outside of those main like six or seven grapes that people already knew, so that you don't get stuck in other. You've got lists with more categories and more options and people who are so much more willing to try those.
Mm-hmm. And that goes to what you were talking about, developing a network of Rhone producers and working together to make those types of wines more popular and or more appreciated by Americans.
And one of the big things that we did, I say we, when I was in high school when this decision was made. It was not I who was making this, but a decision that Jean-Pierre and my dad made that I think has turned out to be really important was the decision after we'd brought our vines through quarantine to not try to keep these vines proprietary and plant them and use them as a competitive advantage, but instead to make available cuttings of these vines to anybody else who wanted to plant them so that we could get these new varieties and these higher quality clones into circulation and help the whole category establish itself.
So you were sharing.
Yeah.
We figured, I mean, the whole idea of like the rising tide lifts all the boats, that really would be true, that if there was a Rhone category that was better established, that would be, in the long run, that would be a really good thing for us.
Mm-hmm. Something that impresses me is the sustainable practices at Tablas Creek, your dedication to organic and biodynamic farming and dry farming and using animals to weed and fertilize. Tell me how that came about.
Because we developed this system in France since maybe 40 years at Beaucastel, my own vineyard. We were one of the first in France to do that. And in the United States, maybe Tablas Creek was also one of the first to understand that it's not possible to continue to use chemical products in the vineyards, and voila. Mm-hmm.
The story that I always love, and I don't know, I hope it's true, but the story that I heard from my dad was that when your father switched to organic viticulture at Beaucastel, he was really blown away by how much more the wines tasted like the place. Beaucastel when they were farmed organically.
Right.
And so that's for us always been the underpinning of why we farm the way we farm, is that it gives us every possible chance to express the character of the place in the wines. And we figure that the less we put on from the outside, the more that we can do there. Like, we don't have to bring in fertilizer from the outside because we've got our own flock of sheep that's going to eat the cover crop and fertilize with their manure. I mean, that's part of emphasizing the terroir, the character of that place, by minimizing what has to go on from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Talk about terroir. We hear that word so much when we talk about wine and how important it is. What is the connection between terroir and then what we're tasting at the end?
Okay, that's difficult to explain. It's the difference between the cépage, the wine from one cépage, one varietal, and the terroir. The terroir is the microorganism and the soil which are working together to give to the vines a very specific wine. Terroir is, I cannot explain in English.
My dad's term for it was somewhereness. Uh-huh. Like, it's the character that comes from something being made in a particular place that is unique to that place, not to the grape that it's from, because the grapes could be planted anywhere, but the character that the place brings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wine from a special terroir, it's impossible to reproduce on another place.
You're tuned to KCBX, and this is Issues and Ideas. You're listening to KCBX's Marisa Waddell in conversation with Tablas Creek General Manager Jason Haas and founder Jean-Pierre Perrin. They're celebrating a big anniversary this year. We now return you to that interview.
How are you celebrating this year?
So we have a range of things that we're doing. We are doing a special tasting all year, which is a vertical tasting, so that somebody who comes out and signs up for our what we call our collector's vertical tasting gets a chance to go back and taste 6 or 7 vintages of our top wine. We're pulling stuff out of the library for that. We're doing events around the country where we're going to be reaching into our library, showing back vintages of wines. We're doing a tasting this summer where we're going to open every vintage of the Panoply, which is the top wine that we make only in the really great years. Mm-hmm. But we'll do that and open that up to the public for the first time. There's a couple of different festivals for which we're going to be the featured winery because it is our 30th anniversary. So I'll be doing that in Santa Fe later this year. And we're continuing to look for other ways to celebrate it. So stay tuned.
And what are some of the things that you each are most proud of when you look back at the 30 years of Tablas Creek?
I am very proud because, you know, the story of Tablas Creek is a story of friendship. But, you know, real friendship, not a friendship for business or for friendship. And now a friendship between two families, De Hasse and Perrin. And I'm very proud of that. Mm. Very proud. Mm. American family, French family.
And Jason?
I mean, what Jean-Pierre said is really the heart of it. I mean, the whole idea behind Tablas Creek came about because the families were looking for a way to continue to work together. And the idea came first. The place where we decided to do it came after the idea and was chosen because of the idea that we had. But for me, some of the things that I'm really proudest of looking back at it is the extent to which at the beginning – some of the really fundamental decisions that Jean-Pierre, François, and my dad made turned out to be right. I mean, the idea that these grapes were going to be really spectacular in this part of Paso Robles where they'd never been planted before, where, in fact, you could go to the top of the tallest hill and not see another grapevine, was outside of the Paso Robles AVA when we bought it. Mm-hmm. But they felt, based on the soils that they saw and the rainfall that they measured and the climate that they knew, that this was going to work. And fundamentally, it's lots of other stuff we had to change to get there. But fundamentally, these grapes in this place was a good idea. I mean, fundamentally, the idea that farming organically from the beginning, and again, there was nobody farming organically when we started in Paso Robles, nobody farming grapevines organically, that was not just going to be feasible, but that was going to be the way to make wines that had the most character and that there would be a movement that would develop around that. That's really exciting. And I'm really proud now that we're a full generation removed from the founding of Tablas Creek. Just saw Jean-Pierre's son, Mark. He was at the vineyard a couple of weeks ago. His nephew, César, has spent a couple of harvests and visits regularly. His brother, François, we still see regularly. I'll be going over there in 6 weeks. It's not just a partnership in Tablas Creek. It's a partnership of ideas where Tablas Creek is sort of the linchpin that connects the families over the longer term.
So you go to Chateau de Beaucastel and you come to Tablas Creek and there's a...
As often as I can justify.
There's a relationship across the ocean there.
Across the ocean and across the generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about why Rhone wines are so often blends.
We actually, this week, we've been working on blending. I mean, that's what we do at this time of year. So we've been blending the reds from the 2018 vintage. And one of the things that comes out every time we do this is that we taste the different components, varietal by varietal, because we ferment things individually. And we say, oh, that one's really good. That one's good, but only good. That one's okay. That one's great. Yet when we put them together, we find the right mix. What we've put together is always better than any of the pieces were. And fundamentally, I think that's why you see them blended, is that they have flavors that complement each other. Mm-hmm. So you've got things like Grenache, which is beautifully fruity and vibrant and has good acid, but can come across as a little candied, can be a little alcoholic. You have Syrah, which is structured and dark and spicy, but can be a little austere. That's an awfully good partner for Grenache. It sort of compensates for Grenache's weaknesses, and its weaknesses are shorn up by Grenache's strengths. And then you add Morvedra, which is the third of the big three, and that's earthy and meaty and chocolatey, and it helps the wines age, and it tones back the alcohol that you could find in both of the others, and you end up having something that has all of the positive characteristics without the negative characteristics.
And I think that it's more interesting for consumers. If you have wineries, they make wine with 3, 4, 5 different grapes, the difference of each wineries are different.
Yeah, it carries the personality of the producers.
And for also for the biodiversity, like Tabor's Creek, we have 15 different grapes for the biodiversity. Mm-hmm. It's more interesting for nature, for the biodiversity, to have more varietals than one.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the ways that you connect with the community. I just recently saw that Tablas Creek is partnering with Cal Poly to do some kind of demonstration of your sustainable practices.
Yeah, we're part of a Cal Poly organized grant that looks into the impacts of tilling versus no-tilling. There's all sorts of things that we're experimenting with every year anyway. Mm-hmm. So this is a project where we're working together with some Cal Poly researchers and grad students who are, and we're setting aside parcels to some that will not be tilled, some that will be tilled, and measuring things like the different carbon content of the soil and the growth of the vines and the growth of the shoots that are in there. We try to be a partner in really anything that is going to either help the community grow or help advance some of the interests that we really care about. So we do a lot of work with MUST charities. They do really incredible work up in the North County. We partner with universities whenever we can. We do a lot of work with the other organizations that promote organic or sustainable farming. We just hosted a dry farming seminar out at the winery with the Community Alliance for Family Farmers, which is an organization based in Sacramento, which promotes dry farming around California. So we hosted an educational seminar and had 30 producers out to try to convince more of them to dry farm. We're doing a biodynamic seminar coming up at the end of June. So, I mean, we try to keep doing these things that are where we can get people out. We can hopefully get a few more people excited every year about some of the same things that we really care about. And we're lucky that we're a part of a Paso Robles community that is so willing to work together and so willing to share ideas and to work to do things a little bit better every year.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody wants to come out and see what you're doing and learn a little bit more about your farming practices and your wine production, how does one do that?
So we do tours every day at 10:30 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. We ask that people reserve it in advance just so that we can have somebody ready, but they're free. We've also do seminars that people can come to. We do 4 or 5 educational seminars that are open to the public over the course of the year. We just finished our annual blending seminar, which is always really fun. And all those are on our website, which is tablascreek.com. That's the easiest place to find it.
Okay. And looking ahead, what do you see in the future for Tablas Creek?
Oh, I see a very good future. You know, the young generations, Jason and my sons, they are very good. And I think that Tablas Creek is one of the very good vineyards in terms of biology, in terms of nature, environment, and wine with no pesticide, no herbicide. C'est bien, c'est okay. They are good. Very good future for Tablas.
Okay. And you, Jason?
I got 2 things that I'm really excited about. One of them is that we're just getting the last of the Châteauneuf du Pape varieties out of quarantine. So we started out with 9 of them. And there's really, well, we started with 9 Rhone varieties, 7 of which are Châteauneuf varieties. There's really 14. And we imported the other 7 in a second batch starting in 2003. And they've been coming out of quarantine little by little over the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we got the last one, Muscardin, out of quarantine last year. So we hope to have that in the ground later this year. And I mean, we have so little expectation for what this is supposed to be like because it's barely planted even in France. But
Heard of it.
It's just incredibly exciting to know that you're working with grapes that in many cases nobody has even experimented much with in generations.
Is Muscardin red or white?
Red, but not very red. It's a kind of a pale red grape. I've just told you everything I know about Muscardin. So well, ask me again in 4 years and I'll have a better answer.
That's exciting.
So that's one thing that I'm excited about. The other thing that I'm really excited about is that, I mean, we started planting our vineyard in 94. We had most of the vineyard planted by 97. So that means that now most of our vines are 20 to 25 years old. That's the point at which in France they really feel like they're going to start showing everything they're capable of. I mean, the roots are down 15, 20 feet. Some of the excesses that they show when the vines are young have calmed down. We've learned how to farm them. I mean, honestly, I feel like we're just hitting our stride. And I mean, grapevines will live a human lifespan. And I can't wait to see what we can do with 40, 50-year-old grapevines.
Well, thank you so much both for joining me today. I'm Marisa Waddell on Issues and Ideas, and I've been talking with Jason Haas, who's the Tablas Creek General Manager, and also Jean-Pierre Perrin, who is one of the founders of Tablas Creek Vineyard, celebrating 30 years on the Central Coast. Thanks both.
Thank you, Marisa.
Listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue with our series on media literacy and find out what some Central Coast librarians are doing to educate students to deal with the daily deluge of information they take in, primarily from the internet.
They need to be very critical thinkers about where information comes from, what it's being used for, and particularly who is part of the conversation and who's being left out of the conversation.
This story and more coming up. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Next up, the newest in our conversation on media literacy, moving the conversation to the library. KCBX contributor Beth Thornton speaks with two Central Coast librarians about their role in fostering inquiry and critical thinking skills with students from kindergarten through high school. And they have some tips for the rest of us as well.
This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas. My guests today are Michelle Hopper, District Librarian for San Luis Coastal Unified School District, and Jennifer Sawyer, Library Media Technician from San Luis Obispo High. Michelle's responsibilities include teaching media literacy to the district's 7,500 students in grades K through 12. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Beth.
As a librarian, you've been at the forefront of literacy for your whole career, but the definition of literacy now includes media literacy, with an emphasis not only on printed words, but images and sounds as well. How has your role as a librarian evolved over the last few years to include media literacy?
That's a great question. I have been in libraries for 7 years, and for the 7 years that I've worked in our schools in San Luis Coastal, we've always had a bit of a media literacy inclusion in what we're doing, even at the elementary level. One of our focuses over the past several years has been on digital citizenship, and that's something happening K-12 in the elementary school libraries. When I first started, we would do 2 to 3 lessons per grade level in our library time. Now, those lessons are also being taught in the classrooms and reinforced in the library. So it's not just our libraries, it's our teachers and a district-wide effort. Our library staff that's on site, they will be collaborating with teachers on media literacy lessons and providing access to different things as needed.
How were you trained in media literacy?
Well, I have my master's in library science from San Jose State. Before that, I had studied at Cuesta to do the library technician certificate and got an AA in library science there. It's an amazing program. I also attend Q conferences. Those are computer using educator conferences. I try to make it to library oriented meetings, CSLA, as well as the California Library Association meeting. This past Q conference that I attended was digital literacy, media literacy, and data privacy.
What is the best age, in your opinion, to start with media literacy education in reference to students?
In reference to students, I would say as soon as possible, even before they become students. I feel that children naturally have a desire to know why. In fact, most three-year-olds, that's their favorite word, and that is something that libraries in general want to encourage, and I think is a foundational piece of media literacy, is fostering inquiry and curiosity, wondering, why is that the way it is? Well, let's find out. Starting in kindergarten, we have information lessons talking about what is true, what is a fact, where can I find out who the author is. In addition, we do digital citizenship and safety lessons with our kindergartners, talking about how we go places safely in real life and how we go places safely online and how some of those same rules apply. So maybe when I go places safely on a field trip or with my family to Disneyland, I stay with my group, I ask before I go somewhere else, I don't talk to strangers, and things like that. And we talk about how those same rules apply when we're online.
Can you tell our audience the difference between digital citizenship and media literacy?
I would say that media literacy is more of developing habits of inquiry, having the skills for expression, being critical thinkers, being effective communicators, and being active citizens. And I think that fits really well with what libraries naturally do, but also it fits with the Common Core and with the critical thinking skills that come from the Common Core through kindergarten through 12th grade. For example, starting in kindergarten, students are encouraged to write their opinion about something, and those opinion essays starting in kindergarten scaffold and become persuasive essays, and they're moving on into even the high school level.
Production is an important aspect of media literacy. What type of production activities do you do with students?
What's being done in the classrooms with Common Core often has a final project or a way to show understanding. So students are creating quite a bit. In many of our elementary schools, we have students using Chromebooks, one-to-one devices, starting in second or third grade, and they're learning to create videos, presentations with Google Slides. They might create screencasts, review books they've read. And that creation process is very important with media literacy, because until you create and until you put something out there, you don't fully understand intellectual property and the copyright issues that go around with it. But once you've gone to that final step of creating a product, it's easier to have that conversation and understanding. Joining our conversation now is Jennifer Sawyer, Library Media Technician for San Luis Obispo High School. Welcome.
Thank you, Beth.
Jennifer, tell us about your role with media literacy at the high school and with the older students.
I have the privilege of working at the high school and working with students as they move into the next phase of their education. And what I love about the role of the Library Media Center at the high school is that we are able to become sort of a consultant in helping the students and the staff to discover, follow their curiosities, follow their passions, really work through those research questions, and become very high-level critical users and creators of information.
With the prevalence of media in our lives, do you envision a time when media literacy education is just simply a part of every lesson?
I think it already is. I think we've already gone there, and I think we've been there for years. And I think the definition of that is what we're starting to see emerge. But that's what our teachers are already doing in the classroom, and that's what our kids are already doing in every aspect of their lives. They are already practicing a lot of those micro skills that have been taught from kindergarten on, and they are able to start applying them in both small and big instances where they need to be very critical thinkers about where information comes from, what it's being used for, and particularly who is part of the conversation and who's being left out of the conversation. So what we're doing at the high school level is encouraging them to take a deeper look at authorship, of creatorship, of the materials that they are using. And we talk a lot about research skills and how being a good researcher depends on being a critical user of information. So for example, in ninth grade, we start everybody off with a research boot camp. So all ninth grade English classes come through a 3-day research boot camp, and everybody kind of starts with a level playing field of these are the definitions we're using for media literacy. These are the issues that we're going to be examining over your next 4 years here. And here are some tools to help you kind of prepare for that.
And I would imagine if the students are getting media literacy in kindergarten, by the time you have them in high school, they're somewhat savvy. Is that right?
They are very savvy, and yet they need practice the same as we as adults do. And so it's having that conversation on a regular, everyday basis in the classroom that, you know, it's not enough to talk about it one time. It's a repeated conversation and a skill that gets developed and that we as adults are still developing ourselves. We really have a number of great opportunities for students to be producers of media in a variety of forms, everything from research papers to what Michelle was talking about with slideshows and videos, to our classes such as journalism, where they're creating a student newspaper, and our digital media broadcasting classes where they are doing digital media production on a daily basis for our student news network, and that goes out to the whole school every day. So there are some very sophisticated types of media production going on. And again, it goes on in little and big ways, really every day.
I'd like to hear from both of you about advice you might have for parents who want to continue with media literacy at home.
Yes, well, I would say, number one, talk with your child about the work that they create, something they bring home. Maybe it's that persuasive essay they wrote. Talk to them about that. Maybe it's websites that they're going to, and that's a conversation starter as well. Our school district has several different digital citizenship and social media workshops that they hold throughout the year. So checking on the San Luis Coastal website for those, or checking in with that site principal about potential meetings that might be coming up. But But also we have a wonderful community of libraries, and Margaret Kensinger-Klopfer downtown at the SLO Library is a great resource at all of our libraries in our community.
And Jennifer, what about advice for parents of older students?
Well, I think in addition to what Michelle mentioned of taking advantage of the workshops that are available throughout the community and hearing from experts on those, on the topics of media literacy and social media, beyond that, I just encourage parents to model information-seeking behaviors for their kids in terms of talk about where you get your information from and why. Talk about the resources that you look at when you're looking for good quality information. And talk to your kids about where they're getting information from. Kids are reading news more than ever today because it is available on their phones. They do have access to a ton of information. So having a family discussion about the different sources of information and talking about it as a family is a really valuable thing to spend time on.
I think our ultimate goal as school librarians is that no matter where you are heading next in life, that you go forward as an independent thinker.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Beth.
That was Michelle Hopper and Jennifer Sawyer from San Luis Coastal. I'm Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Local author Eldonna Edwards has a new novel out called Clover Bloom. It's about a young boy coming of age in a 1970s commune in Northern California. Eldonna will be signing her book at the San Luis Obispo Barnes & Noble on June 1st, and she recently sat down with Brian Reynolds to discuss several of the themes that come up in her new novel.
We're so excited. We've interviewed you before about yourself and literature that you write for largely for young adults, and especially excited about this new book, which covers an era that we're all very tied to, given the era in which we grew up and the social phenomena that were going on. And also like to highlight that the book itself has a bunch of references to local scenes and local events going back maybe 30, 40 years. So your new book, Clover Blue, talk to us about it, please.
Well, Clover Blue, it is coming of age, but it's written for adults, and it's accessible for the young adult or young adult readers, but mostly it's written for adults, literary fiction for adults. And it's about a young boy who's struggling. He grows up in this he comes of age in this commune in the 1970s in Northern California, and he has a little bit of an identity problem as he comes into his own self, and he wonders who his parents are, because the commune or the collective that he lives in, everybody's considered his parents. They're all his moms and his mothers, his fathers, his sisters, and brothers. So it's a book about a search for identity and a sense of belonging.
I found the central character very appealing, very moving. You really feel the joy, and you feel the concern and the questioning. And to me, Clover Blue is a very, very brave person.
He gets a lot of his bravery from his best friend, Harmony, I think. I think even though Clover Blue is the protagonist, he's very earnest, even a little staid, maybe. But his best friend that he grows up in the commune with, Harmony, she is feisty and fierce. She's a little warrior. And I think he takes a lot of his courage from her.
Yeah, I love the idea of, maybe you could use the term Amazon, but warrior woman, a person who's feminine and has all the attributes, but has a lot of courage and a lot of individuality, and is, while understanding what it is to be nice and courteous, they're willing to call out falsehoods when they see them. And that's, anyway, I love warrior women.
Yeah, good. I do too.
And the gender mix too, I think is very interesting, the males and the females in the commune, different personalities and what happens to some of them. You mentioned that the book is for adults, and yet it is young adult protagonists. Have you found that adults are interested? I mean, obviously, you're a best-selling author. Interested in topics about young people, or is that something they read because they have to? Or
I think the audience that tends to be drawn to my books tend to be of a certain age, because my books aren't just about young adults. They're about young adults who grew up in the 1960s, in the 1970s. So a lot of baby boomers, especially baby boomer women, really enjoy the books, even though they're written from a young protagonist. I think we can all identify with every age we've ever been, but especially those age where we start coming into ourselves.
Sure. When I want to get to know somebody, I typically will ask what year you graduate from high school. And the reason is typically a person is about 18 and just almost on the verge of adulthood. And the music, the political goings on, everything, it kind of defines. Of course, when they say, well, I was born in this, or I graduated in this year, and then I go, aha, and it doesn't make them too happy. You know, they I put them into some kind of a box. But I definitely get the idea of us as baby boomers looking back on our youth and remembering things and maybe reevaluating things, too, that we thought were so important.
We see that from a different perspective at when we're now of a certain age, now that we've come of older age, but also the children of people who were born in that era. I think right. they are interested in finding out, the young adults who are interested in finding out what kind of a culture, society that their parents grew up in.
For sure. Before we go on, I want to mention that you do have a book signing coming up.
I do, at Barnes & Noble on June 1st at 2 p.m. I'll be there. And then if you go to my website, aldonaedwards.com, there's a list of all the places I'll be on a summer tour.
Excellent. And that would be the Barnes & Noble in San Luis Obispo.
In San Luis Obispo,
right,
yes.
June 1st, 2 p.m. Please consider that. Put that on your calendar to get an autographed copy of the book. I'd like to shift gears, if it's okay, to some of the themes that you cover in the book, sociological themes that are very interesting and very, I don't know, I guess you're could have, two people could have three opinions about them. But one of the first issues, you talk about definition of family, and I assume that would be probably a birth family, versus, or relatives, versus a tribe. How would you make that distinction based on your book?
Well, based on the book, the community he grows up, it is a family, but it's not his biological family necessarily, and that's what he's trying to find out. Mm-hmm. But even as adults, I moved here from Michigan several years ago, and I had to look for my family, my tribe here. And the difference to me is that the family unit that you grow up with, they're always with you, they're always in you, they're always part of you. Your tribe is the people that you seek out who are mirrors for you, who you can trust, who you feel safe with, who you have similar interests or belief systems. So that's how I would define the difference between family and tribe.
I'm imagining that there's both a positive and negative context to that. For example, if you're proud of being a member of a tribe, it might be, who knows, San Francisco Giants fans or people who, enjoy collie dogs, raising collie dogs and showing them. That, I think, has all kinds of positive connotations. But today, and all the social fracturing that's going on, you hear of tribal as more of an epithet where it's us against them, our tribe against the other tribe. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And it's these very, very divisive times that we live in. I'm hoping that the book also communicates that we're all the same. My first book, This I Know, was about, it was set in the Midwest, and it was in a church. And people asked me, like, well, how is this book different? And I was thinking about it, and it's really, there's some really strong similarities because a church and a head of a church, a pastor, is very much like a commune.
Correct.
They have a shared, a collective belief system. In Clover Blue, there's a guru who's at the head of the commune, and their church just happens to be in the woods, out in nature.
Well, you think of a parishioners as a congregation.
Correct.
And that's probably not far from community or tribe. One of the things that stood out for me in the book, in a bad way, was the reluctance of the guru, Goji. To encourage or allow contact between the tribal or communal members and the outside world. And I'm thinking of a pregnancy, a rattlesnake bite. I guess he wanted to maintain their anonymity, low profile. But those decisions, in my view, or my moral value, they were wrong.
He made some choices that had really, really profound effects on the community, and especially Clover Blue. You and I were talking earlier about fear, and Clover Blue's biggest fear is losing his best friend, Harmony. And when Goji doesn't allow Western medicine and counts on the community healer, you know, to use herbs and things, you know, it really puts them at risk. So yeah. I agree with you absolutely, because I think most leaders are flawed, even when they have good intentions.
Right. You know, the benevolent dictator is probably an oxymoron.
Exactly.
But just by definition,
mm-hmm.
that sort of leads to the other theme, a related theme of personal autonomy versus collectivism. And we're not talking, you know, communism or socialism or dialectical materialism, but I think more on a personal level, the need for people to have an autonomy and a personal identity and also to belong. And it seems to me there's kind of a blurred line or a slippery slope between those two. And part of the growth, I guess, of Clover Blue was hearing Goji and, of course, believing in him and his leadership, and yet getting these periodic clues that all was not well, that the decisions were not the best, maybe for the individuals or the group. And that's probably something that all of us struggle with throughout our whole lives, how independent versus how much we want to belong, something like that.
Yeah, his belief systems and his beliefs and his trust in the person that is beloved to him, it's his teacher. They're homeschooled as well, and Goji teaches him a lot about philosophy and world religions, Sufism, Buddhism, all this stuff. But his trust and his faith in his leader begins to fracture as he gets little bits and pieces of information that don't quite fit or make sense to him. And that's when he starts asserting his own autonomy and striking out on his own and on Harmony's behalf.
What about that need to belong? And maybe in the cases where it actually compromises an individual and where they alter their views or alter their perceptions or priorities, give it up for the group. Do you think that's always a bad thing, or how do you portray that in the book?
I think it's a dangerous thing, certainly, and there are a lot of risks that comes with it. Quite often, these are broken people who have unmet needs. And they find them through this sense of belonging. Maybe they had the death of a parent, or maybe parents who expected certain things of them that weren't what they wanted to be. For instance, you know, Goji's father wanted him to follow in his footsteps and be a lawyer. And one of the other characters, Wave, his parents poo-pooed his ideas about becoming a musician or surfing. And so when you have these broken people who are searching for a sense of belonging and they find it, certainly there are risks involved, because when you become a sheep, there can be problems.
Yeah, my barber invented the concept of sheeple, which is, anyway, it's not a very good connotation. I'd like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by local author Eldonna Edwards, talking about her books, but especially her new book, Clover Blue, about a young man growing up on a commune in Northern California in the 70s, an era that many of us can relate to. Let's talk about the idea of utopia versus dystopia and how real that is, and how people make that happen. Do you think that's probably what motivated these communes?
I do. I think that the idea of this utopian society was much more romantic than the reality of it. And when I was a teenager, I knew of a commune in close to where I lived, and some friends of mine invited me to go to the commune and actually commune sit, you know, while the members were away. And after about 3 days of freezing my butt off and eating gruel from the co-op, and it was just mush, you know, stuff, grains and stuff, and I was so ready to go home for my home-cooked meals. So the fantasy there, it kind of ended there, but I've always been extremely intrigued by the idea of the commune, and especially, and there were some successful ones that, you know, lasted for quite a while, and there actually are a few on the East Coast, I think, that are still going pretty strongly. But when it comes down to it, living outside in they live in a treehouse, basically. So the reality of, you know, walking around in mud and cold and using an outhouse and having to take care of the outhouse and clean it out and shovel the compost from the they have a couple goats, and it's grueling.
Right. I have those of us who are meat eaters, probably we don't think very much about how an animal is raised or, you know, how it winds up on our plate. And, you know, we sort of delegate that to others. But in these communes or really on any kind of a farm or a ranch, you'd be face to face with this. Sometimes I wonder how many people, when they hear the word or use the word communism, they pronounce it like this, communism, because the very, probably not the first by any means, but the in American history, there was a whole flock of them in the 1800s, 19th century, the Amana colony, I want to say maybe in Ohio, Midwest somewhere. There was a Cahuilla colony at the foot of the Sierra Nevada, and the idea was that they would share and share alike. They were business people, but they would share the produce. Maybe they shared wives, I don't know, but they shared. And it was, in, I guess, in some way reminiscent of the Native, some of the, most of the Native American tribes who felt that Mother Earth was literally that, a mother. It wasn't something you could own. You know, it was your everyone's inheritance, everyone's responsibility. The idea of any one person owning things, including dirt, the earth under our feet, was an alien concept. And maybe those communes were trying to get back to that. Most of them didn't last very long, that I'm aware of.
Unfortunately, no. I did research and read about some of those other ones. There was actually a commune, I on a research trip, I found out there was a commune that wasn't located not that far from Freestone. And people asked me if it was about that one. And no, it comes from my imagination. But they didn't last long, because what happens is they create these ideals, hopefully ideal situations, but they evolve because humans are humans,
right.
And there's going to be jealousy, and there's going to be people who don't think some of the people are sharing the workload, or
right.
There's going to be power struggles. It still happens. There is no perfect world.
As we wind up the show, what are some one or two takeaways that are really salient for you in your quest as to be a successful author? What would you want to leave people with, ideas and hope?
My biggest hope is that when people read my books, they come away with a sense of feeling satisfied, that when they read about these characters, they see themselves, that there's a mirror held up for them, and they see themselves in the characters, and they care about the characters. One of the best compliments I ever got in a review is that my writing is unhurried but never slow. And,
wow.
And that's what I love that. It's not a page-turning thriller. It's a story. And it's about people that you'd recognize at the grocery store, in the schoolyard, your neighbors.
Yeah, I just love that that image of a good book. You lose yourself in it, but you find yourself in it. Isn't that interesting? Kind of a paradox, but very true. And a French philosopher, I want to say Montesquieu, that said that there was no problem so severe in life that a couple of hours with a good book couldn't make better.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, as a reader and librarian, I certainly can resonate with that. We are talking with Eldonna Edwards, local author on KCBX Issues and Ideas. And there is a book signing coming up June 1st.
June 1st at 2 o'clock at Barnes & Noble in San Luis Obispo.
Right. We encourage people to do that. And your website is?
EldonnaEdwards.com.
Excellent. Eldonna, I hope that we can do this again soon with your latest book. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author Eldonna Edwards. Thank you, Eldonna.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Next Monday is Memorial Day, and we'll be running a special program instead of Issues and Ideas, which will return Monday, June 1st. In the meantime, you can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.